Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It is Saturday, which means it's time for the Front Three bonus podcast. I'm Adam Boward alongside the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Hello.
And we are here, guys, with the man, the myth, the legend, that is Rory Jennings. Rory,
welcome. Thank you. It's an honour to be on.
Oh, it's an honour to have you, Rory.
The first guest.
Yeah, the first guest on one of our bonus podcasts. What we're going to do, guys, is talk to people we like, friends of ours, people we admire, people we respect. We want to kind of delve into why they're a football fan, delve into the history of their clubs and how the beautiful game touches them. Of course, Rory, you are a Chelsea fan. I mean, let's start at the beginning. I mean, how did you become a Chelsea fan? What's the story there?
It's a really boring story, I'm afraid. It was inherited. I had absolutely no choice in the matter. It was something that was passed down to me. I was taken to my first Chelsea game when I was four. And that was that, really. A love affair was born.
Do you not ever think about, you know, maybe supporting a different team? It was non-negotiable, was it?
It was completely non-negotiable. I'm from North London, so in my family there are some Arsenal fans, and they often would try and woo me. But my side of the family were having none of it. It was Chelsea or nothing.
And of course, you know, we all know what the modern Chelsea are, and you know, there's all the jokes about there's no history before 2003. But I mean, what was it like to be a Chelsea fan before Roman Abramovich? Because there is history there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think that the majority of people who try that, you know, kind of founded in 2003 thing, they know what they're doing. You know, it's a wind up. I think that everybody who follows football knows full well that Chelsea have a rich history. And the period, I would say, my most glorious period following Chelsea, a lot of people would think it would be Mourinho's first season. You know, I think we accrued 95 points, which was a record. We won our first league for 50 years. It was huge. But that actually isn't the period of football that I look back on with the most amount of, say, romanticism. For me, it's a period in the mid to late 90s when Chelsea were just glamorous again. We had an incredible team. We won the FA Cup in 97. There was some glamour back on the King's Road, and that is a period. We had some wonderful football players. You know, Gianluca Vialli was playing for Chelsea. Roberto Di Matteo was playing for Chelsea. Dan Petrescu playing for Chelsea. In amongst all that, you had the players who were there for longer than that. You know, you had John Spencer and Dennis Wise, and there was just a moment where it was a perfect mix of everything that was great about old football and everything that's great about modern football were combined.
It was quite an exclusive era, wasn't it? Do you think Chelsea could do that now?
in terms of.
Just in terms of, I mean, it seems like so 90s, that combination of those two things.
Yes, I think football's moved on from that, sadly. I think that a lot of what happened with the Premier League revolution and the amount of money that came into the game, it changed it. But for a small period, there was Ruud Gullit became Chelsea's player manager, and he was playing alongside Terry Phelan. There was this moment of old football, new football, you know, working together. And it coincided with Chelsea having this glorious moment of, you know, winning a League Cup, winning an FA Cup, winning a Cup Winners' Cup, winning a Super Cup, beating Real Madrid in 1998 in Monaco. Those things all came together, and it really was great. You know, I'm not for one second am I not saying that I've thoroughly enjoyed this Roman Abramovich era and the Mourinho periods of, you know, over a decade ago now, were incredible. some of the most wonderful words I've ever seen. But maybe just through being nostalgic, there was a few years pre Abramovich, the mid to late 90s, when Chelsea Football Club was just incredible. You know, we really were brilliant. We could have won a league, actually. We could have won a league in 99, the year that United won the treble. We beat that United treble-winning team 5-0. And it just all went a bit wrong. I think it was Leicester. I'll never forgive Leicester and Steve Guppy. It was Steve Guppy on the left wing ruining our dreams. But there was a chance.
Steve Guppy.
Yeah. So, that was the era. That's the era that I look back on most romantically. You know, the big kit, the big collared kits, the ridiculous coloured kits. Dennis Wise playing alongside Ruud Gullit. It was just a wonderful period.
Yeah.
Chelsea had three player managers in a row as well. You had Hoddle, Gullit, and Gianluca Vialli as player manager.
Well, it all started with Hoddle. What Hoddle did for Chelsea Football Club will be forever. You know, we are forever in his debt. He came in, and obviously because of the man that he was and because of the way that he played football, he was a man ahead of his time on the ball. He could woo players like Mark Hughes and Ruud Gullit. And suddenly we went from watching a team who were full of fight and tenacity and a very good team. But we went from being a team that were sort of an okay cup side, maybe, to a team that could realistically win the league and were probably the most glamorous side in the league at the time.
Mm. I mean, Chelsea won a fair amount, as you said, Rory, that under Gianluca Vialli as well. The FA Cup, League Cup, Charity Shield, and as you said, the UEFA Cup Winners' Cup as well. Not enough player managers these days.
I think it's a
dead breed, isn't it? It is dead. Edgar Davids did a few years ago for a Barnet. That didn't really work out that well. I'd love to see a player manager.
Sean Dyche.
Yeah. Well, he can get on the pitch now. Just lace up. He's ready.
Yeah, I reckon Eddie Howe could have a game. Eddie Howe
probably could have a game. Yeah, you're right.
That guy, there's obviously the big story at the moment is Julian Nagelsmann, who's the manager over at Hoffenheim. He's 29 years old, but I think he's not going to be able to get on the pitch anytime soon. Anyway, obviously talking about Chelsea, Rory, as you talked about there, the Abramovich era. I mean, as it started, it was all about Jose Mourinho, man. What was your sort of thoughts and feelings at the time about this manager coming in from Porto? I mean, was it excitement? Was it nervousness?
Yeah, well, it was such an exciting era. I think the Abramovich coming into Chelsea took the whole of the league by storm. Nobody knew what to expect. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Until that point, Chelsea hadn't won a league. You know, this is going back to the thing where we say Chelsea had no history. We won a league 50 years previously. So there is a rich history there. But we hadn't won a league for 50 years. Nobody took us seriously at winning a league. It was never a possibility. And Abramovich came in and all of a sudden we became this team who, you know, we became a club that was signing some of the most sought-after players in world football. You know, players, we signed Juan Sebastian Veron, we signed Joe Cole, we signed anybody who was exciting. They were on our radar. And we were beating sides to players. Sides, Manchester United and Arsenal were forever, you know, signing the best players and had first dibs on anybody. That suddenly all changed. And we then went into that year where Arsenal were an incredible team, and throughout my entire youth were a thorn in my side. I mentioned previously that I have a lot of family who are Arsenal fans. Chelsea couldn't beat Arsenal. It really was a thing. No matter what we did, no matter how well we played, we could be 2-0 up with 10 minutes to go and we'd give in. We could be 2-0 up with 15 minutes to go and Kanu would score a hat-trick, including a goal from a corner flag. We could be 1-0 up at Highbury and Cudicini would let one through his legs for Henri to tap in. We could never beat Arsenal. All of a sudden, we're playing Arsenal in Europe's premier competition. We're playing Arsenal in the Champions League. This is the invincible Arsenal. We knocked them out of it. We beat Arsenal at the zenith of their game. It was the most wonderful Arsenal team. You know that. You know the side. It was the Bergkamp, Omri, Vieira, Lundberg, Pires. It was just the zenith of football. It was the best team that the Premier League, arguably the best team that the Premier League had ever seen up until that point. And we beat them in Europe. I would go so far as saying actually that result was a Wayne Bridge goal at Highbury, the old Highbury, and I was there, and it was just incredible. And I think that goal actually set the tone for everything. We then went on, and in true Claudio Ranieri fashion, at least in his Chelsea days, we went on and messed it up. We went on and played Monaco. We played Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank right back, and it all went wrong. Morientes actually killed us. it all went a bit wrong. But it meant that Arsenal didn't get to the final. I'm convinced Arsenal would have beaten Mourinho's Porto had they got to the final. Wow. And as a result, Mourinho won the Champions League and became Chelsea manager. So it all came down to that moment where we beat Arsenal.
It was that first season. I mean, as you said, it was the first league title in 50 years, but it was an incredible season. I mean, they set a number of records, fewest goals conceded in the Premier League, the most clean sheets, the most wins in a season. And as you're saying, the squad that they assembled, I mean, bringing in the likes of Didier Drogba, who obviously became a legend. Ricardo Carvalho is obviously an important player from Mourinho's former club, Porto. I mean, the squad they assembled in that first season was sensational, wasn't it?
It really was sensational. Do you know what I think is a really interesting debate? That season, we only lost one game. We went away to Manchester City. This is obviously pre-Manchester City's brilliance. And lost. It was Nicolas Anelka who scored a penalty for them. It was the only game we lost all season. But in that year, we managed to accrue 95 points, which is still a record. Which is obviously far more points than the great Arsenal team that I was just talking about. Or the great Manchester United team that won the treble. It'd be very interesting to know what people think was the best. Like, for me, the team that accrues the most amount of points is probably the best team in the league. But, you know, you can make a valiant case for it being the team that goes undefeated in the league. Or you can make a valiant case for it being the team with the trophies. But for me, it's a team that, you know, 95 points. And also, I mean, I know this is pretty incidental, but it was 95 points. We'd won the league with four games to go. We didn't win a game. We didn't win a game for the last three games. So it was 95 points. I think we're at 93 with three games to go. You know, we had we wanted it, had we needed it, had anybody been pressing us, we had it in us to get 100 points. Like, for me, a great Premier League team is like a really solid Premier League team is the 90-point barrier. I think if you're winning the league with anything sub 90, you're worthy champions, of course, but you're not special. 90 for me is a benchmark. Wow. We had 100. And that team, that year that we won the first league that we'd won for 50 years, you know, Drogba pinging in goals, we had Paulo Ferreira right back. It was just brilliant. I had 100 points in it. And then the next season, we did it all again.
Yeah, it was part of it though, wasn't it? Do you think that the reason that people don't remember that side particularly fondly is because they didn't particularly like that team?
I think there is an element of that, of course. I think that there is a perception and of course a semblance of truth to the statement Chelsea bought the league. There is a semblance of truth. I think it's far more complex than that, and I think that we've seen countless examples since that buying the league doesn't work. Simply buying the league doesn't work. You know, Leicester won the league last year and didn't spend any money. You know, it's far more difficult than simply buying the league. But I think that the fact that Chelsea injected so much money into their side in such a small space of time rubbed a few people up the wrong way, and they don't look. And also, I think this is another fallacy. People look at that team and they don't see it as being an expansive football side. They don't see it as being an exciting, you know, they when you think about some wonderful goals that Bergkamp scored, they look back on that more fondly than they do, say, what Chelsea were doing.
Yeah, that is unusual, isn't it?
I think it's a myth, because some of the most beautiful football that I've ever seen played was Drogba leading the line on Arjen Robben on one wing, Damien Duff on the other wing, and, you know, Frank Lampard and Joe Cole doing their bits in the middle, coming through with Claude Makélélé protecting everything. That really was, you know, some of the goals scored in that period were wonderful. And I just think that because of Mourinho's functioning, approach to the game, there were times when we got 2-0 up after 15 minutes and nothing else would happen in the game. Like, that would be it. And I think that people kind of look back that and they don't necessarily give it the respect that it deserves.
Was that the peak for Chelsea under Roman Abramovich for you, Rory? Because obviously they won those back-to-back titles, and of course, although there was success after that, it has kind of almost been a little bit of a struggle in a way. There's been a lot of turnover, of course, with the managers. Was that peak Chelsea?
No, actually, we went to Bolton Wanderers away and we won the first league that we won for 50 years. And I was there and there were 50 year old men crying. It was one of the most wonderful moments. But I will be forever thankful for what Mourinho did there. You know, like I said as well, we did it again. We did it the following season. We went out that summer and we were champions. We went out that summer and bought Michael Essien, and he was the most coveted midfielder or player in world football at the time, and we did it all again, which was so impressive, and we're so thankful to Abramovich and Mourinho for that. But I actually think that more glorious moments have been with us since. Mm. You know, I think we won our first ever double. You know, Tottenham Hotspur, the famous rivals of ours, true love of yours, Adam.
Yeah.
Tottenham, the thing that Tottenham Hotspur would always have over Chelsea was, you never done the double, mate. You know, they did the double you're always hearing about. Danny Blanchflower and Tottenham Hotspur, the glorious side of the 60s, who did the double. And it's something that evaded us countless times. We did a double. We did a league and a league cup double, but we didn't do the double.
The double.
We didn't do the double. And the double is so, it means so much to me, I think, because the FA Cup means so much to me. I hold the FA Cup in such high regard that the double really is a special thing. And it was under Carlo Ancelotti that we achieved that goal.
Well,
and
I mean,
that was also huge.
We'll come on to him in a second, but I mean, in terms of Mourinho leaving, he left at the start of his fourth season, essentially. What did you make of that? Because it was quite unexpected, of course. It was all said to be by mutual consent. Seemed to be growing tension between Mourinho and Abramovich. But what was your sort of take on the whole situation?
It certainly felt at the time that it was the wrong decision, but there were, the results hadn't been going particularly well. We had a very, very unflattering result in Europe. We played a Scandinavian side. I can't quite remember who now, but we drew 1-1. It might have been Rosenborg.
Rosenborg.
And it was flat, and the performance was flat, and there was irritation within the first team. This sounds very much like a situation that's about to replicate itself 10 years later, doesn't it? And Mourinho and Abramovich pulled the trigger. At the time, as a fan, it was definitely not the right thing to do. I felt that Mourinho certainly had more to give. I think that his record after that, what he went on to do at other clubs, you know, Inter Milan, Real Madrid, and back at Chelsea ultimately, proves that he had more to give. But the timing, while I was anti the result, the timing, I do sort of understand why Abramovich went down that road.
That season, of course, despite the poor start, as you said, that 1-1 draw against Rosenborg, they did manage to reach the Champions League final. Avram Grant, the manager, leading them. I'm sort of doing air quotes, which you can't see. But, I mean, what do you make of Avram Grant and getting to that final and the way it all sort of panned out there, the disappointing defeat on penalties?
I never like to sound disrespectful to anyone who's managed Chelsea Football Club, but I think that I don't think I'm speaking out of line if I say that we got to that final in spite of Avram Grant, rather than because of Avram Grant. I think that it was a team we were perennial underachievers. Yeah. We were a very good team. You know, we were doing very well, and we played Tottenham in the League Cup final. We got to the final and we lost. We then got to the Champions League final and we lost. We then blew it in the league, and it was just one final defeat after another final defeat, and it was low. I mean, I was in Moscow when Terry hit the post, and we were robbed. Actually, you know, it's a shame. We were so good. You know, I think Manchester United probably had the best of the first half. But from that moment, from that moment on, we were excellent. I think we had Michael Essien playing right back as well, which was, you know, it's not his normal position, but he did an excellent job. And it was just a real shame because we were so excited, we were so buoyed. And it still went a bit wrong. Didier Drogba got himself sent off. I think, with a clash with Nemanja Vidic. And yeah, it was, you know, that then led to John Terry having to take a penalty. And the rest is history. And it's weird, actually. I was there. Frank Lampard scored for us. It's a goal that I've never seen. I managed to miss it at the time. I had to pop to the loo when we scored. So I missed the goal live. And obviously have avoided any footage of that game ever since.
Oh, really? So you've never seen the goal?
Never thought to watch that back? Goal, yeah.
Never, no. It, you
too
know,
painful
it was
to
of,
it.
It was one of those that I remember sort of organising with my mum, make sure that you record it. And by the time I got home, it was immediately scrapped from the planner.
I mean, we're talking about how good the Chelsea team was in that era. They still had the foundations of that Mourinho team, such as Drogba, such as John Terry, Lampard, all those sort of players. The Manchester United team as well was incredible at that time as well. And both teams get into the final. That probably was the height of English football in the modern era, especially in the Premier League era.
Oh, definitely. Well, when you think of all of the battles that we've had over the years with Liverpool, that was because it was Chelsea and Liverpool who were forever in Champions
the
League
two,
semi-finals.
Yeah, technically the two best teams in England for 2 or 3 years.
Definitely. Definitely, yeah.
And or at least the most tactically adept, I'd say, maybe.
Definitely. And, yeah, there was a time when the English sides in Europe were the feared sides. You know, you can even take this slightly further. You go back to, say, 2006. It was Arsenal in a final, wasn't it? Liverpool were in a couple of finals. Then Chelsea were in a couple of finals.
I think it went Liverpool-Arsenal. Liverpool.
It went Liverpool-Arsenal-Liverpool, yeah. And yeah. Liverpool-Arsenal-Liverpool, Chelsea-Manchester United.
Yeah.
Huge. Nice and then Manchester United again. It was Manchester United 09, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Manchester United Barcelona at Wembley. So, yeah, I mean, the English sides of late have really let themselves down on that front.
Obviously, after that season, Avram Grant finished second in the league. He was sacked and in came Luis Felipe Scolari.
Oh, no. Do we have to do this?
Yes, he did come in. He came in.
That was in the hope of playing Brazilian football, wasn't it?
Yes, that was exactly.
Beautiful football. And everyone was like, well, this is how it works out. You know, that's why he got rid of Mourinho. He wanted to play beautiful football, which is technically true. He did. He said he wanted Ronaldinho and those sorts of guys, didn't he?
Yeah, desperately. But do you know what? You said exactly what you said there, Lawrence. It's so accurate and so flawed, isn't it? It's a chairman who I love. You know, don't get me wrong. We are so grateful to Abramovich and I passionately sing his name at Stamford Bridge. But there are occasionally... Come on, mate, you can't do that. You can't just like decide, oh no, we're not gonna do this anymore, irrespective of the players we've got. Let's go Brazilian, we're gonna win every game 5-3. Let's get the Brazilian manager in, sign some Brazilian players and hope for the best. It was ludicrous.
Looking back is so weird though, isn't it? Because actually it's not like Brazilian football was in, I mean, you know, if you talk to Brazilian experts now, maybe you talk to a Tim Vickery or someone like that, they say Brazilian football hasn't been in its pomp for such a long time because of Brazilian things that it's sort of a bit of a weird one to base it on. And it looks like the kind of, like you say, the kind of decision made by a football guy who doesn't quite get...
Well, it's what I do on a computer game.
Yeah.
It's what I do on a computer game.
Although now you do, I mean, since then, you've signed some great Brazilians, so...
Yes, yeah, of course, but they're also... I think what we've signed is wonderful footballers who happen to be Brazilian, rather than trying to play a style of football and making that fit.
Like, yeah, they've been shaped in Europe, those players, really, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah. But that period, and the funny thing is, there's two very dark eras, and I'm sure that we're going to come on to another one, and Lawrence and I will have a serious debate, the Rafa Benitez era.
We'll be serious.
The Scolari one really was terrible, and it started so well. I can remember... If I remember rightly, anyway, we played Portsmouth first game of the season. Deco was the man, you know, brought him in. He pinged in a goal from, you know, 45 yards or something ridiculous like that. We won 4-0, opening day, top of the league, sun was shining. And, you know, the Samba beats were kicking. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment.
It was all going well for the first 13 games, essentially. And then it all started to go wrong.
It all started to go wrong, yeah. And do you know what I think? I remember some of the players coming out at the time and talking about it. They were so they felt undertrained. Like, you know, the training sessions were very short. I think they'd gone from being kind of drilled under Mourinho, fitness drills and everything being so on point, that suddenly it was just, you know, let the flair take over, out you go. And yeah, we were dreadful at times under Scolari, really bad.
He obviously was gone by February. Goose Hiddink came in. The upturn in form was immediate, and of course, just went on to win the FA Cup final in 2009. I mean, how fondly is Hiddink remembered because of those effects he had during the season at Chelsea?
Well, from that first period, very, very well. We played some good football under him. He really steadied the ship, and we actually managed to go from that terrible position to launching quite a serious bid for the Premier League. Again, this is all from memory, but if I remember rightly, we felt like we could have won it. We won a lot of games in a row. We seemed to go full throttle for the league. And it was actually a Luka Modric goal at White Hart Lane. Again, we lost 1-0. I can remember being there in the upper tier. And that was the moment that we couldn't win the league. But he did exceptionally well to make it even a fight, to make us even contend. For the league, you know, Hiddink did brilliantly, and then we went on to win the FA Cup under him. So at that point, Gus Hiddink was seen as a bit of a saviour. You know, winning the FA Cup at Wembley was always brilliant. I think it was Frank Lampard scored against Everton with a left foot, you know, 30 yards, his usual bread and butter stuff. And at that point, we were eternally grateful to Gus Hiddink, and his name was held in very high regard. That may have changed. But at this point, you know, in 09, that's certainly where we are.
You spoke earlier about Carlo Ancelotti coming in that next season, obviously winning the double, you know, Chelsea's most successful season ever domestically. I mean, that team as well, although they didn't reach 90 points in terms of their final league tally, I mean, they scored 103 goals over the course of the season. I seem to remember that team just obliterating teams in the Premier League.
That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened under Ancelotti. And the way that he was treated after doing so well for us, the way, like, if reports are to be believed, he was actually sacked in the tunnel at Goodison Park. That's where he was told that his tenure of Chelsea was coming to an end. And it was moments like that that really did, you know, the chasm between supporter and fan, as supporter and club, you know, the people who make these decisions, there's been moments where it really does feel like the disparity is so huge. And it's moments like that, it's reports like that, that really make us look at the board and go, what are you doing? This is a man who we love. He's completely thrown himself in and embraced everything that is Chelsea Football Club. You know, he loved South West London. He bought a restaurant on King's Road. He became Chelsea. He was one of those, you know, we've had a number of them, Italian Chelsea players who just really gets it. And he was cool. Fans loved him. He used to like this famous thing where he gave a fan a cigarette. the fan asked him for a fag when he was in the dugout, and he gave him one. He was just a very, very popular figure. And that football that we played was at times just unstoppable. You know, we had a forward line that was just full of goals. We had Frank Lampard doing his thing from midfield, probably better than he'd ever done it. And I think it was all the microcosm to demonstrate this whole point is, I think last day of the season, I think we ended up putting 8 past Wigan, and that took us to the 103, which again was a record. And yeah, and then we went and won the FA Cup against Portsmouth. So yeah, he really is somebody who we hold in such high regard. And there are times, in fact, I'm sure there'll be times again, whenever there's a Chelsea vacancy, whenever there is a moment of instability at managerial level, Carlo Ancelotti is always the he's the fans, he's championed by the fans immediately. He's I would go so far as saying one of the only people at Chelsea who's completely, like, universally loved. Carlo Ancelotti is looked on so fondly by so many.
Yeah, I mean, that decision to sack him at the end of that season in the manner they did it. I think they finished second that season, didn't they? They were 8 or 9 points behind United, but it just seemed so short-sighted at the time for a manager who, as you say, brought that double to Stamford Bridge.
Decision. Do you know what I think it is? I think the debate is, and I think that it's a very, very interesting one. The debate is there's two styles of managers that you can employ on. There's two ways of doing it. And at this period at Chelsea, we felt like, at least, we were craving what Arsenal had and what Manchester United had. You know, that long-term, stable, let somebody build a side. But that is one way of doing it. You know, you get somebody in for the long haul and you allow them to put their blueprint onto the team at all levels. You know, and Manchester United was run under Alex Ferguson from the under-8s right through to the first team in his manner. That is one way of doing it. And that has been a very, very successful way of doing it. There is another way, though, and this isn't necessarily what Chelsea fans wanted, and it certainly at this period it isn't what we were crying out for. But with hindsight and what we're about to discuss next, you can see where Roman Abramovich seems to come from. I think he subscribes to the paradigm where you don't employ people like that. You employ people on very short term, and they're impact managers. They come in, they do something wonderful, and then you get someone else in and they do something wonderful. And then you get someone else in and they do something wonderful. It's not what fans like. Fans want to feel an affinity to the man in charge and you know, grow a love. And then they feel a love and a loyalty, and they don't like the person being mistreated. But when he was sacked, of course, you know, he won us a double. Things in our mind then couldn't get any better. But then 2012 came around.
It's That's the point, isn't it? Because it seemed Ancelotti being sacked seemed to set off quite a rocky period in recent Chelsea history, but also while bringing probably the greatest moment in the club's time. I mean, Andre Villas-Boas was the man to come in. He just won the Europa League with Porto, with a fantastic Porto side, sort of pledged his future to the club, but I think Chelsea managed to convince him to join. It was an interesting period because AVB coming in, a young manager, was potentially seen as you say, Roy, that long-term option the fans wanted. Maybe he's going to be there for an extended period of time. There was all the talk about how the squad needed to transition. The foundations of the Mourinho era were eroding. They needed to bring in new players to go to a new era. I mean, how do you feel about the way AVB handled it and how he was treated?
Well, see, it's very interesting you say that about the transition because while I have no time for Villas-Boas, I think he got some things massively wrong at Chelsea, and then he did the dirty on us. You know, he went to Tottenham, which is just a ground that you shouldn't tread. Whether it's Gordon Jury, Gus Poyet, or Andre Villas-Boas, it's not what you do. But he did it, and what I think is quite important is I have an element of sympathy for him slightly because I feel like he was bought into Chelsea with a remit of shaking it up. We felt like the team that was in place, it was pretty much the same. It was at least the same spine that had, you know, won a league, the first league, eight years previously or whatever it was. And they felt like there was need to come at it from a different angle and to rejuvenate that side. And I think Villas-Boas was brought in with a remit to do that. I think as soon as he tried to employ it, player power, and rightly so, you know, like when you think that he was trying to take Frank Lampard out of that side. He was trying to drop Ashley Cole out of that side. It was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. It needed to be done in a far more clued up and cryptic way than he was doing it. He just came in, and I think at one point as well, he made Florin Malouda, who was a very, very popular player among the players, he made him trade with the kids, which is just completely disrespectful. The way that he went about doing everything was really, really messed up, and it was no surprise when he got sacked. But there is an element of me that kind of thinks he was given a bit of a rough deal because at the time he was brought in to shake it up. And so he was brought in to shake it up. He came in, he shook it up, and he got sacked.
I also think he was told that he could shake it up. I also think he was told he could transition those players on. And part of the reason he was told he could transition those players on was because those players were so loyal to Mourinho.
Mm.
And it's definitely it pissed Abramovich off a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, John, the power that Mourinho wielded at the club is something that doesn't sit comfortably with the people who run the club. And I would actually think this time last year, when there was a debate about John Terry's future, the power that John Terry wields at the club via the fans is not something that sits comfortably with the people who run the club. So Villas-Boas was brought in to shake that up a bit and, you know, let's imprint something new and get rid of the old guard. And
you've seen this Mourinho 2.0, but playing better football.
Yeah, that's exactly what he was
perceived as better football. Yeah,
but yeah, it didn't work out. And the way that he went about it, the way that he went about treating some of the players who were held in very high regard, he made an enemy of the fans very, very quickly. Me being one of them at the time, massively.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But I remember it really well as you say, I think he maybe tried to do too much too soon, or the way he went about actually trying to move on certain players wasn't the smartest way to do it. But it got to March. Things weren't going too well. They'd lost to Napoli in the first leg of their Champions League tie. obviously losing to West Brom was the final straw in the league. Villas-Boas was removed. Di Matteo came in as the caretaker manager. He was the assistant manager under AVB. And I just remember that second leg against Napoli.
It was the most glorious night at the Stamford Bridge.
Incredible.
In recent history. Yeah, it was. The Stamford Bridge hasn't made that amount of noise since about 1995, when we played Bruges, and it was like our first European exploits, because we got to the FA Cup final in 94 and ended up in we lost the final, but we ended up in Europe. And it was a brand new thing for Chelsea fans, and the volume at the bridge, the old bridge, was really, really huge. Nothing has been replicated like that apart from that Napoli game. It was unbelievable. Yeah, we were 3-1 down. 3-1 down, I think I was at the game. We went 1-0 up while Mata scored for us. We went 1-0 up in Naples, lost the game 3-1.
Yes.
And it was a huge moment. There was a huge, huge moment. I think it was Cavani who's gone through. He's gone round the keeper. And he's shot. He's got the whole goal to aim at. He's shot. And Ashley Cole, who is undoubtedly the best clearer off a liner ever, Ashley Cole has thrown himself at the ball, managed to clear it off. Like, that puts Napoli forward. Game over, yeah. Ashley Cole manages to make it in the 86th minute or something like that. Ashley Cole clears it off the line. And for 1 second, you just thought, just maybe, coming back to the bridge, a 2-0 win is what you needed at the time. You kind of thought, just maybe there's a chance here. Then we had a massive week. Our hero was employed. A man who's probably given me more happy moments than any other man in the world, Roberto Di Matteo.
I thought you meant Rafa Benitez.
was employed. And yeah, there was an air. Obviously, that game at Stamford Bridge, it was just wonderful. I remember every moment of it. Naples, they brought so many fans over. There were lots of sort of pockets of trouble, because Napoli fans were in amongst the home fans. They really did come en masse. They were expecting a win. They were worthy of a win. They played brilliantly. And somehow it was Di Matteo, and there's a very famous image actually of John Terry really giving tactical advice to Di Matteo. It was a huge team event. Yeah, it was brilliant, and it went to extra time. We won 3-1, so it went to extra time, and then Branislav Ivanovic popped up and just pinged one in to the roof of the net at the shed end, and the noise was deafening. It was truly, truly wonderful, and it was in that moment where we thought, This isn't normal. Everything that's going on here isn't normal, and there is potential.
It was it was just such a turnaround, because from the turmoil under AVB to then after that game to be the only English team remaining in the Champions League in all European competitions was quite something. And then obviously to go on, I mean, obviously no one was giving Chelsea much of a chance, Rory.
No,
especially in that semi final.
Well, yeah, I think we played Benfica. Next and got through. I think Kalou scored, and then it was Barcelona, and
that game. I mean,
that game. Yeah, I just cannot believe it. It's still something. It's still one of the most fascinating, unreal experiences ever. Like the fact that we got that result. I think the overriding image, I think it's an image that surmises everybody's feelings towards it, is Gary Neville's voice as Torres rounds Valdez.
Yes, to completely put it to bed. It was just so, I remember watching at the start and sort of thinking, there's no way Chelsea are going to do this. There's no way they can beat Barcelona.
Well, no, it all went wrong.
To see John Terry get sent off.
Fouled Sanchez, didn't he? John Terry fouled Alexis Sanchez.
Crazy.
Got sent off.
Crazy foul. He seemed got to like, knee him in the back or something.
Yeah, idiot. I know, and then was banned for the final, which was such a shame. But got sent off.
Was he banned? Because I thought he celebrated. And
created one of the greatest sort of Chelsea jokes of all time for everyone else. So I'm forever grateful. But yeah, to be down to 10 men in that leg, and to
be down to 10 men, and then do you know what the moment was? The famous image, I've just conformed to exactly what I don't like, which is the Torres thing. But it was the thing that made it so, so special was Frank Lampard. We're coming up to half time, we're 2-0 down, we're down to 10 men, everything's going wrong. Lampard picks the ball up in his own half under pressure, sort of spins on it and plays one of the most incredible assists ever, because he plays it blind and he chips it over. Ramirez goes flying through on it. You you know, he's a player who I love. I really do, and I still do. But one-on-one with the keeper isn't necessarily his forte. He's chipped him. He's chipped Valdez. You're like, oh my lordy, what are you playing at? And it's nestled perfectly into the corner. Him. That made it 2-1. 2-1, suddenly the aggregate score sees us through. And we think, surely not. You know, they've got 45 minutes. They've got 45 minutes to find a goal, because we're not going to find another one. Unbelievably, they didn't find one. Lionel Messi hits the bar from a penalty. Didier Drogba gave away a penalty late on, and we just think, oh no. Messi smacks it into the bar. Then the ball drops to Ashley Cole. Ashley Cole does the biggest punt ever, like definitely not picking Torres out, just getting rid of it. The camera, like footage that now that I find so entertaining, is that the camera can't really keep up with Torres.
Yeah.
Suddenly Torres is there in the...
He just appears, yeah.
Why is he there? What was he doing? Like, we were defending. We had our backs against the wall for 45 minutes. Why on earth is Fernando Torres on his own in the opposition half? And, yeah, coolly rounds Valdez, slots it in. And we're off to Munich to face Munich.
And, yeah, as you said, Gary Neville with some of the most famous commentary
ever.
That is a great impression. Great impression. But then, yeah, that was it. The final at the Allianz Arena. Obviously, a close game. I think closer than people were expecting. But then, 83rd minute, Müller scores. You're thinking, well, that's that, isn't it? They've won that. They've deserved to win that game. And then somehow... I know Fernando Torres gets a lot of credit for winning the corner.
Fernando Torres did win the corner, but do you know what we've just glossed over here? And I can't quite allow that to happen, just especially with Lawrence there. We won the FA Cup.
Oh yes, you did win that beforehand.
We won the FA Cup. We beat Liverpool. Yeah,
what a massive achievement!
Just wanted to slip that in.
I think it then becomes this is why Mourinho is so in such a difficult position when it comes to kind of looking back on Chelsea glorious moments, because you'd say Di Matteo winning the FA Cup and the Champions League has to be the best thing ever. You then have to say winning the double under Ancelotti is the second best thing ever, and then Mourinho's achievement of winning the league and the League Cup. So it kind of puts Mourinho in Chelsea's history. It kind of puts Mourinho at third place.
Wow. Okay. I mean, that's interesting in terms of the achievements. I guess it kind of...
In terms of the achievements, yeah.
Makes sense. But, I mean, the achievement of Chelsea... I mean, talk to me about that final, Rory, because, I mean, were you never expecting to win? Did you think it was all done and dusted in that sort of 83rd minute to come back in the way, you know, with that header from Drogba and for it to come down to penalties? I mean, what were you feeling there?
Well, look, going to Munich to face Munich, you know, they're playing a home game, and I was out there, and obviously, you know, Chelsea had their allocation of tickets, probably 25,000, probably 40,000 went. But any neutral area obviously falls into the hands of the Germans, because it's in Germany and, you know, they snap up the tickets. So we were hugely outnumbered in the stadium. It did feel like a home game to Bayern. You know, they had a big display earlier, just before kickoff, kind of calling it, I think the slogan was, our team, our stadium, our cup, you know, something along those lines. Unser Pokal, whatever that means. I can remember it written up. And it basically translates to, you're in our stadium and it's going to be our cup. And obviously you maintain hope, but the forces seem so against us. You know, John Terry was out. He was our best defender at the time. Branislav Ivanovic was out, who was one of our best defenders at the time. David Luiz was so injured that under other circumstances would never have played. He effectively played with one leg to win us the Champions League that day.
Literally.
No, but it was awful, because he was sort of limping around in the warm up. This doesn't bode well. This really doesn't bode well. You know, when you've got the
Ryan Bartrand was starting left wing as well, I think.
In his Champions League debut, Bertrand started left wing. It was a Gary Cahill, and David Luiz centre half partnership, which felt, you know, shaky. It felt like we were up against it, but there was belief. You know, we'd won the FA Cup, we'd beaten Barcelona. There was belief. That belief came crashing down, obviously, when Müller scored. It was
so late on as well. Yeah,
so late on. And yeah, it was harrowing because the stadium erupted. They thought that it was a job, you know, job done. It was the sensation that you got around the stadium. And looking around the Chelsea end where I was, yeah, it wasn't a nice place to be. People were so upset. People were close to tears. I was close to tears, and it felt like, here we go again. You know, the haunting images of Moscow came flooding back to me, and you think, here we go again. It, like you said before, Torres won a corner pretty much out of nothing. He did well. He chased the lost cause, won a corner. Juan Mata whipped it in, and Didier Drogba unleashed the most bullet-like header I've ever seen. And yeah, it gave Neuer no chance. We erupted. I can remember I was with my friend, and naturally everybody jumps up. I've gone up onto the seat. It's all gone wild. My mate has actually deflated and sat down. He was just completely overwhelmed with passion. I kind of jumped off the seat. Everybody's screaming. Yeah, people are screaming. People are falling over each other. People are tumbling down the aisles. It was wild. My mate just sat down with his hand in his head. I was like, what on earth are you doing? Mate, are you all right? It's completely overwhelmed. You know, it's like the whole experience was too much to cope with.
What was it like then, Rory, when Drogba, it came down to Drogba, Bayern had missed two penalties?
Well, they'd also missed the penalty in extra time. Arjen Robben missed the penalty during the game, and that was the moment. That was it. Arjen Robben missed the penalty, and that was the moment that we said,
"This
can happen. This can happen." David Luiz went up the other side. So the penalties were given at the other end. Typical. I think Juan Mata had missed, David Luiz had scored, Cech had saved one. David Luiz did something brilliant as well. Like I said, he played with one leg. And then as he scored, he pinged one into the top corner and ran into the Bayern fans and really did give them some grief back, which was what we needed. You know, it really did G everybody up. And Drogba has a chance to win it. Moscow, the shadow and the spectre of Moscow was still there. John Terry stepping up. With Drogba, it felt like he was going to score. I thought he was going to score. Whereas every penalty up until that point, I didn't think anyone was going to score. I felt like Drogba was going to score. I've actually asked him subsequently. I've had one conversation with him since where I've actually said, did you know you were going to score? And he said 100%. 100% knew it was a goal. Before I'd even lined it up, it was a goal. And then it hit the back of the net. The collective sigh of disbelief from the German fans was truly great. and they played one step beyond and we'd done it. We'd become the first London club to ever win the European Cup. And that is the best thing ever.
Still struggled to get over it, to be honest, to sort of believe that Chelsea won it, because obviously Chelsea are a huge club and obviously the quality is there. But for them in that season, the way they were playing and the turmoil, for them to win against these teams who probably should have been beating them.
It was the worst Chelsea team to compete in Europe that won it. You know, we'd had some excellent teams.
Yeah, after all those efforts, all those times.
The 09 team when Barcelona, Iniesta scored that last minute, Michael Essien had scored a volley, yes, and then we went out. That team deserved it. Arguably the 08 team deserved it. Arguably a team when Liverpool beat us on penalties in 05 deserved it. This team, they certainly deserved it through grit and determination and effort and everything, all those things. But in terms of footballing ability, it was lacking compared to some of our other sides. And that made it all the more sweet.
You spoke about how Avram Grant, Chelsea got to the final despite of him. I mean, how's Di Matteo viewed by Chelsea fans? Obviously, the man who brought the European Cup to Stamford Bridge. But in terms of his part in that achievement,
Roberto Di Matteo deserves a statue at Stamford Bridge. Roberto Di Matteo has single-handedly changed the shape of Chelsea Football Club on numerous occasions. He scored a goal in the FA Cup final. It was a record at the time. I think Luis Saha broke it against us.
Yeah, I remember.
Luis Saha broke it against us when we played Everton. But it was Di Matteo's record. I think it was 42 seconds. That goal set us on the road to winning our first FA Cup for 27 years. Then again, he scored a goal in the League Cup final, won us another thing. Then, as a player, he's had his impact. He's done it as a player, as well as scoring countless big goals in the league. You know, his career was sadly cut short. He got fouled. We played St. Gallen in Switzerland in a European Cup game, and his leg was destroyed. And it was a shame because he was a marvellous football player, so technically gifted, so clever, such a keen eye for a pass. He did all that for us as a player, you know, scoring such big goals, winning us trophies, to then come back and do it as a manager and guide us to the biggest ever trophy, a trophy that we've never won, a trophy that no London side has ever won. We were at race with Arsenal to be the first London club to win it, and we won that race because of him. It's not dissimilar. I know in terms of the magnitude of it, I'm not getting carried away here. I can see what I'm going to say could be ridiculed, but it's not dissimilar to the impact of Charlton at Manchester United. You know, he did everything as a player. Wow. He then, you know, it's not dissimilar. It's doing things as a player and then coming back and doing it again as a manager. Roberto Di Matteo definitely deserves more recognition than he gets at Stamford Bridge.
It went.
And the way that he was treated, the way that he was sacked. I was in Turin. We played Juventus. We played Juventus and got well and truly whooped. You know, really, you know, when it's really bad, we lost 3-0, but it could have been about 8. So I don't think we touched the ball. Really, really bad. And we were at the airport and news started to filter through that he was sacked. Di Matteo was sacked. And that was a crusher. That was heartbreaking.
I mean, do you think it was unfair? I mean, I think everyone wanted to see him rewarded with that contract in, I think they gave it to him in June at the end. There was a lot of speculation about whether Roman Abramovich was actually going to reward him with the job. Mm. He did get a 2-year contract in the end. But as you say, by November, after that win with Chelsea, with Chelsea on the verge of becoming the first ever European Cup champions or Champions League champions to be knocked out in the group stages the next season.
We've got a few of those records. We were the worst defending Premier League. We've got a few of them. Yeah. But was it the correct decision from purely a football basis? Arguably, yes. Probably, yes. But
emotionally,
you can't. Yeah, I don't think, you know, but certainly not me as a fan anyway. Maybe this is why I'm not on the board, which more to the board's detriment. But maybe they don't approach it with the same amount of romanticism that I do. Obviously they don't, and perhaps they shouldn't. But equally, I think you are allowed to be slightly forgiving to somebody who has given so much and such brilliant moments. It was a wrong decision to sack him. But when you look at his managerial career subsequently, it hasn't been a bed of roses.
No, and I think I always felt like Abramovich was waiting for the excuse, essentially, to get rid of Di Matteo because he didn't think he was a long-term option. It was a little bit of a shock when he was dismissed only a couple of months into that season, though. Perhaps more of a shock on the same day for them to announce Rafael Benitez, former Liverpool manager, as interim coach until the end of the season. What was your reaction at the time to that, Rory?
Well, do you know? You know, I think this will demonstrate the point perfectly from a Chelsea fan's perspective. I think if you were to ask a Chelsea fan, if you ask 10 Chelsea fans, can you give us please your greatest ever moment following the club and your worst ever moment following the club, you would get 10 different answers for your greatest moment. Some people would say Bolton in 05. Some people would say Amsterdam 2013. Some people would say Munich. Some people would say knocking Arsenal out of the Champions League. Some people would say beating Manchester United 5-0. Some people would say beating Tottenham 6-1. Some people would say beating Tottenham 4-0 twice in 3 days. There are so many. There are so many reasons for your greatest ever moment following the club. You asked 10 people your worst ever moment following the club, it would be unanimously the day that Chelsea employed Rafael Benitez.
What? So for those who don't know, what is the reason that Benitez inspires such animosity in Chelsea fans?
Because, and it's a credit to him, and it's a credit to the Liverpool side of which he was a manager, because he was a huge rival of ours. Antipathy and rivalry in football is a good thing. It's not something that should be frowned upon or discouraged. It's part of the fibre of being a football fan. You have hatred towards certain people and certain clubs, and that should be encouraged. You know, don't cross a line, don't be an idiot. But equally, rivalries and hatreds are part of following a football club. Rafael Benitez was the principal man and the manager of a Liverpool team that countlessly got one over on us. Of course we don't like him. He said, as well he should have done, he said some very disparaging remarks about Chelsea because he was a Liverpool manager. I mean, it's not a personal thing. He did exactly the right thing. He said what he should have said for the position that he was in, and he conformed to the position that he was in. He was a Liverpool man saying things that Liverpool fans wanted to hear, saying things that would benefit his Liverpool team to the detriment of Chelsea. I have no issue with him doing that. That's exactly what he should have done. But I can't like him for that, of course. It would be like saying to a Liverpool fan, you're a big fan of Didier Drogba, right? You know, now you've got to support him. Or now you've got Jose Mourinho, now you've got to support him.
It would be like saying to a Manchester United fan, you have to support Jose Mourinho.
But I think the thing is with that, Chelsea fans, in fact, we can use the Manchester United thing that Lawrence just mentioned there as a bit of a case study. Chelsea fans in this circumstance are, in my opinion, and if you just hear me out, I think cover themselves in glory because the term plastic is often bandied around, right? They say plastic fans, you know, no heart, no soul, swing in the wind. What Chelsea fans demonstrated there was, irrespective of how well Benitez did, and he did well, we still had no time for him. So it was
great.
It was in fact the exact opposite of plastic because we didn't like him beforehand. He then came in, secured Champions League qualification, won us a European Cup, a European Cup, and we still didn't like him. We stuck to our guns. It was the exact opposite of being a plastic supporter. It was being a supporter true to himself.
Sticking to your principles.
Yeah, I see both sides. I obviously see you wouldn't like him. I also find it just really unusual Rafa Benitez must just be a sucker for punishment because it's just so, you know, as much as you didn't want him, I imagine it wasn't the ideal situation for him. There must be a reason why he went there. And it was probably money.
Money would certainly be a factor, but he's had an excellent managerial career and he's a very good manager, as he's currently proving at the moment.
I also just think he probably wanted to prove that to some extent. Do you know that? I also think that he had.
I think it was a super troll as well. I think he found it quite funny. Like, you know,
I also think it was a bit of a weird one because I think he partly seeks approval, and I think he realised the place that he didn't have approval was not necessarily Chelsea, but definitely London. And I think as much as Chelsea fans didn't like him, I think a lot of journalists in that time grew to like him, and because they'd never been to, you know, a press conference at Anfield or whatever beforehand.
Yes.
They grew more affection for him, and they were like, oh, I didn't realise he was a nice guy. And I would sort of be like, well, what, you've never been to one of his press conferences before? And they were like, well, no, obviously not. You'd be like, well, then... Get on a train, mate. Yeah, and I guess that's also part of it, is that I feel maybe in the first place, if the London press had been a little bit kinder to him or sort of portrayed him in a different way, maybe it would have made some fans feel a little differently about him.
There were moments where he called, and whether it's right or wrong is irrelevant. Like, I'm not saying that Didier Drogba has never dived, but it's not my responsibility to do that. Football is a tribal game and we have our allegiances, and it's important that we stick to those, like it's important that managers stick to theirs. But when Benitez came out and called Didier Drogba a diver, that irritated me, and it irritated other Chelsea fans. Whether it's true or not, it's neither here nor there.
Why?
Because it's not a rational... It's football support isn't a rational thing. It's very much irrational. It's, you know, you've got people who support Fleetwood Town singing "We're by far the greatest team the world has ever seen," and more fire to them. They should sing that because they know that isn't true.
You know, they know that isn't true. And ultimately, like, you know, I think that's the difference, isn't it? Is that they're singing it ironically, or they're singing it in a way because they believe they're the greatest team in terms of support. They're clearly, no one there is ever saying we are the greatest team on the pitch. And if they are, then, you know, they must have reason for that.
But football, at least in my opinion here, shouldn't be so rational. We shouldn't. It's football is something that's allowed to be. You're allowed to think things that aren't obvious. Like, you see a referee call something offside that you know is offside. If you're in the stadium, you're like, what are you talking about, ref? Of course it's not. Of course it is offside. But you're not sitting there as a, you know, football support is meant to be unilateral, partisan support, at least in my opinion.
It's
supposed to be unilateral support for your side against whoever you're playing.
I find that very interesting because it also, I've spoken to a lot of Spurs fans recently as well, and interviewed a couple of other fans. That sounds like there are a few mentalities that are very specific to a few different clubs. And I think, you know, the Spurs fan that I spoke to, first of all, was a very apologetic man, and secondly was someone who just sort of said, well, you know, we're pessimistic and aren't all football fans. I was a bit like, actually, no, not all football fans are quite pessimistic. And then it's quite funny to hear you say this, because it's a very Mourinho, it's a Mourinhoism, or a Mourinhoism, if you like, because he has a very creative way of dealing with the truth. And there are other people who say, well, surely if you want the best for your club, you would look for the most realistic and the most rational route to go, because you realize that you want to get to the zenith of your powers. And arguably that is why Mourinho took Chelsea there, because he was very he made the truth very malleable, but at the same time was very realistic with what they could achieve, and instilled that within his squad and made them all believe in the harsh reality of what Mourinho painted.
Yeah, I think it's a Mourinho thing, but I also think look, Mourinho definitely conforms to this. Mourinho's a football man, but I think that this is wider than an individual. I think when we have a debate over who's a better player, nobody approaches those conversations rationally. Generally, if you talk to a Chelsea fan, who's the best player, Rio Ferdinand or John Terry? The Chelsea fans will tell you John Terry. The Manchester United fans will tell you Rio Ferdinand. If you do the same debate with Frank Lampard or Steven Gerrard, same split. People don't approach these things rationally.
But at the same time, it isn't something that's quantifiable, is it? Like, that's not most people would say, well, you know, that what you're asking there is for a definitive on a subjective. It doesn't make any sense to be able to do that. But you know, if you ask someone, definitively, so say you could say to Mourinho or Benitez, definitively, where would you put this player? And, do you believe that he's going to win you titles? Then a manager could give you a very honest answer and say, actually, I think I need a different defender. They've got something that's quantifiable there. You know, did this guy have a good game? Well,
yeah, I suppose. I just don't think that's a fan's responsibility. For me, a fan's responsibility, the way that I approach my fandom is unilateral, partisan, bias support.
Yeah,
I mean, not to the level of idiocy, but that's,
well.
But for 90, well, okay, yeah.
I mean, consider it just.
Yeah, but that's how I go into it, and that's why I think the Benitez thing irked a lot of people so much. Okay. Like, there's some footage. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but there's some footage. Chelsea played Brentford, which are pretty much, you know, it's not a million miles away. It's pretty much a local derby. We were away, and to get to the dugout at Griffin Park, you cross the pitch. So you come out of the tunnel at one side and cross the pitch. At half time, you've got to have a look at it. It's on YouTube. At half time, Benitez, I think we were 1-0 down. Benitez has to do the walk across in front of the away fans to the tunnel, and the support is the Chelsea support is so hostile and so loud to Benitez, to our manager at the time. It's unbelievable. I think that video, the conversation that we've now been having for about 10 minutes, we haven't really got anywhere. I think that video will completely surmise exactly how Chelsea fans were feeling at the time.
It felt, yeah, I think he was never going to be a popular figure. I think that perception from most outside of Chelsea at the time was, God, it's going a bit overboard, isn't it? I mean, the treatment of Rafa Benitez. But
yeah, no, that was definitely the position from outside was absolutely that. We evoked sympathy for Benitez. I think a lot of people just kind of felt this has gone too far.
I think other people also really enjoyed it. Like, they enjoy watching, you know, Chelsea fans and Chelsea suffer, but through winning. Like, that was what was so unusual, was it was like, oh, God, we won a cup.
They're really not happy, are they?
There was something really funny about it, because it was like, well, normally, there are so many other fans that would be absolutely ecstatic to win that. Like,
you. Oh, no, we were ecstatic to win that trophy. So, winning that, we won that. It was, you know why that trophy was so important to us? We are now the only English side, and I think the only other two sides that have won it are Juventus and Ajax, to have won the four European trophies, you know, so including the old Cup Winners' Cup. That completed the set for us. We've now won the Grand Slam, and we're the only we're the only British club to do it, and the only two other clubs are Ajax and Juventus. So us winning that was huge. And also, now it's all in the past. Now I can look at it slightly more detached. Of course I'm grateful to Benitez for coming in, steadying his ship, winning that trophy, qualifying for Europe, of course. But at the time, it just didn't sit comfortably. It wasn't a good fit for Chelsea. Combine that with the fact that it was to the detriment of a player who I just said deserved a statue at the club. It was a perfect storm.
The next season, Mourinho returns. Rory calls himself the happy one after a mixed period, I'd say, Real Madrid. A difficult period, potentially, for him.
He was unrecognisable, wasn't he, when he came back?
Yeah, I mean, what was your reaction to him coming back? Because he seemed, and he, to this day, seems like a different man since...
Yeah, I agree. I think the happy one is nonsense. I think that you can pretty much draw a line in the sand for Mourinho's character, and the line is pre and post Madrid. So the man who arrived at Stamford Bridge 10 years previously was this young, handsome, innovative, daring, exciting, difficult man who had the world at his feet and whose tactics were pioneering and world ahead of his time. The man who came back to us post-Madrid was a slightly old, cynical, boring, just a man who didn't necessarily elicit love. He was hard work. And we didn't have a bad season. We got to the semi-final and should have probably done better. Semi-final of the Champions League, I think it was Diego Costa who knocked us out of it. Us out of the Champions League. But then it was the next year. So that, you know, he had a sort of year to bed in. We did pretty well, but it was nothing to write home about. And the following season, he made some big signings. You know, we got Cesc Fabregas in, we got Diego Costa in, and we pretty much won the league at Canter. You know, we shot off the traps really, really quickly. Manchester City caught us up a little bit due to goals from Frank Lampard. Do you know what? I can remember, actually. It was an awful moment. Frank Lampard is my hero. He's a man who, if I could have a cup of tea, if I could invite anybody round to the flat in West Hampstead for a red tea, it's Frank Lampard, yeah. And I remember I was travelling on a train to White Hart Lane, which it was on New Year's Day. And I had this big banner that said, "We won 6-1 at the Lane," and I was terrified someone was going to spot it. You know, I'm on a train to Bruce Grove or whatever. And I'm checking the scores. It was a late game. I'm checking the scores. And I think it was Southampton. Southampton were holding Manchester City. I thought, oh, fantastic, fantastic. This is such good news. If we, you know, win this, we'll open up a gap. They won 1-0. It was Frank Lampard. And just for one second, I was like, for God's sake, Frank. Frank Lampard, Manchester City in touch. It was awful. That night ended appallingly. Obviously, Harry Kane had a game of his life. And
great night.
Yeah. And we lost 5-3. But in true Mourinho fashion, we went on to win the league and then beat Tottenham in the Terry goal. So it all panned out and Mourinho was back.
Yeah. But I mean, that seemed to be, obviously, as you say, it was at the start of that season when Chelsea was so impressive. It sort of seemed to slow down in the new year. Sort of after that defeat to Spurs, it never seemed to quite reach the heights it had at the start of the season. I mean, what do you make of the implosion the next season? Because it seemed to start there, essentially.
I think there's a case for when you said it started, but I would say that it started slightly later. I think it started on the 1st of March when we beat Tottenham in the League Cup final and then really slowed down. It really didn't. We didn't play well that year, that calendar year. I mean, we didn't play well at all. But after we won that League Cup, it was limping towards the trophy. You know, we knew we were going to win the league. We were confident we were going to win the league. We were getting the results. I think we beat Manchester United 1-0. Scored, but it was a diabolical game. Really, really poor. But we were getting the results. You know, it was a terrible game. It was a game that we probably definitely didn't deserve to win, but we won it. We then beat Crystal Palace at home again, 1-0. You know, I think this is telling the story. And won the league. And it was great. You know, I don't think when you're top of the league and when you've won a cup already, you don't necessarily realise quite how poor things can be behind the scenes. And yeah, you know, as soon as Cesc Fabregas and Diego Costa stopped linking up so well, it became very apparent that there were problems. And then it was the first game of the following season. We played Swansea at home. The infamous Ava Carneiro issue became prominent. We drew the game 2-2. We then went away to Manchester City. And lost 3-0. Mourinho had dropped John Terry from the starting lineup, which was unheard of, particularly when we were shipping goals. We couldn't get a win for love nor money. We ended up, but we beat West Brom, I think, 3-2. Fluked it, but it was bad. It was really bad, and it didn't improve for the entire season. It was awful.
I mean, were you happy to see the back of Mourinho when he was finally sacked?
I certainly couldn't use those words. I'm never happy to see the back of Jose Mourinho, simply because of, I have to pay homage to everything that he did previously. You know, Mourinho turned the tales of, and turned the fortune of Chelsea Football Club around, guided us to the first league. But trying to take it, trying to remove the emotion, trying to take it, you know, as the facts, there was a terrible, terrible day when we went away to West Ham. We lost 2-1. Mourinho got sent to the stands, and I think, can you remember, Tamer Hassan and Danny Dyer managed to get some sort of selfie with
him. Yes.
And the bubbles were all blowing around, and it was, you know, I was at Upton Park that day, and it just felt so, it just became like a trudging, difficult life with Mourinho. We'd lost the game, comfortably lost the game, showed no real fight, and then, you know, the headlines were all about Mourinho being sent off, being in these selfies with Danny Dyer. And it just didn't improve. We then went to Stoke. We went to Stoke in the League Cup. Went to extra time and penalties and lost. And I was driving home. That's low, isn't it? And going out on penalties to Stoke, getting out of the Britannia at 11:30, and yeah, getting back into London about 2:30 in the morning. It was just so grim. And the writing was on the wall. We could feel that it was going to happen. And well, with hindsight, it wasn't the wrong move, but it was painful to see someone who we love so much fall so low.
Yeah,
like, we were in a relegation battle. There's no two ways about it. There was people constantly saying, you know, Chelsea were never going to go down. We're never that bad, but we were 17th.
Yeah,
we're 17th with 10 games played. Like, that is relegation.
Obviously, Gus Hiddink came in to sort of help steady his ship, perhaps. Not the right decision. Didn't seem to be massively popular among Chelsea fans, but the club did end up finishing 10th. Obviously, as you mentioned earlier, that is the worst defence of a Premier League title in the Premier League's history, although Leicester look like they're going to make their own bid for that this season. But it did seem to mark the end of a period where, although there was that massive success in 2012 with the Champions League, as you said, that sort of search for any sort of long-term stability seemed to be lurching from one manager to another, essentially. You know, Mourinho coming in, he was talking about how he was going to be there for a long time. He wanted to build a dynasty at Chelsea in his second spell there. Obviously, didn't last very long. But Antonio Conte coming in now, do you think he is potentially the man to bring perhaps a longer term success, a longer term spell to the club? Because, I mean, at the start of the season, there seemed to be doubts over the squad and doubts over whether Conte could turn it around, but he seems to have proven all that wrong now.
Yeah, well, what he's done with the players available really is brilliant. He's turned around a club, like you say. We finished 10th, and it was limping to 10th as well. You know, it was draw after draw after draw under Gus Hiddink. Some of the most uninspiring football I've ever seen. It really was bad. And it was a pleasure for that season to end. You know, we got knocked out of the Champions League by Paris Saint-Germain in February, and I think slightly later that, maybe March, we got knocked out of the FA Cup by Everton. Our season was over by early March, and it was just awful. It was just awful. You know, we still had a role to play in the title race, because we had that, you know, the game against Tottenham, and then we had the game against Leicester on the last day, which we thought our season, this is a new low. For me as a Chelsea fan, even when I was going to the Bridge in 1990, this is a new low. Our objectives that season became two things. Like, this is, you know, there were 15 games left to play. Our objectives became beat Tottenham, lose to Leicester. That became our objective. Make sure that we do everything we can to get a result, to do effectively make sure Tottenham don't win the league. And that is for us. That's not what we want to be doing. You know, we want to be winning leagues, not hoping you don't win a league. And
yeah, it seemed quite a turnaround for that to be the be all and end all of of Chelsea.
Yeah, and it really was. It really was the be-all and end-all. And I think the celebrations at the game that finished 2-2 when Eden Hazard scored that goal will testify to that. I certainly never went more crazy for a goal last season than I did that one. I think that let's remember the result was 2-2. The way that we greeted the final whistle, a very special occasion at Stamford Bridge, you play their madness song One Step Beyond. That's played when you beat Manchester United 5-0 or when you beat your title rival late in February. Like, that's when you play that. We played it at 2-2 against Tottenham. Like, that's how big the result was.
To deny Spurs the league, essentially, or to confirm that they were going to win. Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're coming up to that game later on today. I mean, some people called last season the Battle of the Bridge, but it was a kind of... I think the animosity was staggering, to be honest, because, I mean, obviously Tottenham and Chelsea had never liked each other, but that, as you say, last year it seemed like the bad blood went to another level completely. I mean, obviously going into this game, Chelsea are on an incredible run. I think it's 6 games in a row they've won without conceding a single goal. Spurs, on the other hand, form's been pretty patchy. Got a lucky win against West Ham last week, I think it's fair to say. You know, a number of draws in there, a number of injuries, players out of form.
Still undefeated, though, Ad.
Still undefeated in the league, which is the bright spot. But, I mean, are you thinking this afternoon Chelsea are going to end that unbeaten run for Spurs?
I do think it. Yeah, I do. I do think Chelsea are going to win, and I really, really hope we win. No result, no single result. If you take a result with no context, you know, just put a result in a vacuum. No single victory this season will mean more to me than Chelsea beating Tottenham. In fact, maybe one result will mean more to me, and that will be Chelsea beating Tottenham at White Hart Lane. But
wow,
yeah, this is the one. This is the one for Chelsea fans. Chelsea versus Tottenham. We sing about Tottenham every single match. Chelsea will chant about Willian hating Tottenham and how much we hate Tottenham and how rubbish Tottenham are every single game.
Have Spurs Chelsea fans always been at that level of animosity, or is that something that's grown recently, do you think? Because for Spurs fans, obviously they hate Chelsea, but it's all about Arsenal for Spurs.
I think that the animosity may have grown a tiny bit. I mean, it's always been there. I think it may have got slightly more spicy last year simply because of how brilliant Tottenham were. And the fear of Tottenham winning a league was crippling. Like, it was taking me over. I remember, you know, I'm not one for watching, like, streaming Tottenham games. But, you know, if Tottenham are playing and Chelsea aren't playing, I'll try and catch the highlights or whatever. You know, if I'm at home in the evening, I'll probably watch some Netflix with my fiance. Tottenham played Stoke last season. And I was like, Victoria, be quiet. I'm streaming a football match. And I ended up having to, after about 15 minutes, Tottenham were 3-0 up. I was like, sod this, I'm putting Netflix on. It was completely consuming. And the fear that you were going to do it was up there. The other fear is we are so, like, passionately proud of our astonishing record against you at Stamford Bridge. Like, there are a whole sector of Tottenham fans and Chelsea fans who will have never, ever known Tottenham win at Stamford Bridge in their lifetime.
When Tottenham last won at Stamford Bridge, I think I was 2. The Premier League didn't exist.
And Gary Lineker got the winner, didn't he?
Yes, and I think you sort of tweeted out that, you know, at that time, Antonio Conte was a 20-year-old player playing for
his hometown club of Lecce.
Yeah, that's how sort of long ago we're talking. I'm not massively confident that Spurs are going to be able to end that run today, as I said, because of the form that we're on. We've got a few key injuries. Toby Alderweireld's out. Danny Rose is suspended. So not massively confident. I mean, people are talking about this, though, Rory, as kind of a potential acid test, not just for Spurs, but also for Chelsea. You've also got Manchester City the week after. Because of this run, people are starting to talk about Chelsea as title contenders. For a lot of people now, they're actually title favourites because of the lack of European competition as well. I mean, do you think this season they are good enough to win the Premier League?
We are in with a shout of winning the Premier League. We are going to rely on other teams dropping points. We're not going to be the team to set the bar. It's going to be, can we finish? We're going to finish with X amount of points. If everybody else finishes below that, then we're going to win the league. But we're not going to run away with it. I don't think we're quite good enough to do that. Current form is unbelievable, though. But for me, fresh in the memory is, you know, it was only, 6 weeks ago that we went to Arsenal and were so badly outplayed and were 3-0 down at half time. And the week prior to that, Liverpool really gave us a lesson at Stamford Bridge. So those two results, back-to-back results as well, are still very fresh in my memory. But since we've gone to this new system, we're playing three at the back. David Luiz is the best defender in the Premier League at the moment. His form has just been unbelievable. Adam, it's so good. He's so, so good. He's ironed out the creases. Every time he gets the ball, if there's an element of danger, he whacked it into the stand. He really does, without any hesitation, puts the ball out. You know when you're a kid and your manager used to shout at you, if in doubt, kick it out. He has adopted that and made it his mantra. Probably got the tattoo. But he's also doing two people's jobs. What he's doing is, and it makes Chelsea such a dangerous proposition, is he defends as valiantly as John Terry. So he's doing John Terry's defensive work, but also he's adopted the role of Cesc Fabregas as chief creator. Mm. The majority of our attacks start with David Luiz at the back. David Luiz is doing two people's jobs. He's doing Fabregas' job and John Terry's. And as a result, people can't mark him. Does the striker pick him up when he's picking the ball up in midfield and playing an assist into Pedro's feet? Or is it meant to be the job of the midfielder, which then creates more space for the likes of Hazard or Matic or whoever's there? It all stems from this excellent form. Of course, I have to give honourable mention to the likes of Mox Alonso and Victor Moses, who have allowed this system to breathe. Yeah. Gary Cahill becoming a competent defender is something I never thought I'd see. But, you know, it's great. But I'm going to give the praise and the reason to David Luiz. And since we've adopted this system, we haven't conceded a goal. And we have obviously we've won every single game.
Is the one thing that worries you though? I mean, I've said to you a few times, it seems like Conte's got the perfect system, that all the jigsaw pieces seem to fit. But if one player, one element of it disappears through injury or lack of form or whatever, is that the fear for you that maybe Chelsea will suffer in that respect?
Definitely depth. And I would say that's Tottenham's problem as well. I think depth is an issue.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think our depth is such an issue as Tottenham's across the thing, because I would say that we are in, you've got to remember, Chelsea's two best defenders at the club currently aren't in the team. Kurt Zouma and John Terry currently aren't playing in the first team. So, you know, we have cover there. Willian, who was our best player last season, is currently not in the starting lineup. So we have cover there. John Obi Mikel would be an able deputy for the likes of Kante and Matic. He's not playing. The problem for me, and it's really, really, it does feel like a problem, and it's just a shame that, because it's been something that we have had a chance to figure out and we haven't. What happens when Diego Costa gets injured? Like, you know, when we won the league under Mourinho, the reason that we won the league was, of course, Diego Costa's brilliance in front of goal and Diego Costa's phenomenal strike rate. But the reason that we actually won it was because when Costa was out, when Costa was off the boil, we had a player like Didier Drogba or Loic Remy to come in and nick you a goal.
Yeah.
Those boys are so valuable. They come in and they nick you 5 goals a season. And you know, those 5 goals are worth 10 points or whatever. And that wins you the league. Mm. And I just don't think we've got that at the moment. Batshuayi is thought of highly, but, you know, I don't think he's going to lead a line the way that Costa can.
Before we finish up then, let's hear a score prediction for this game today, Rory. Chelsea-Tottenham, what are you saying?
I'm saying Chelsea 4, Tottenham 0.
Bloody hell. 4-0?
4-0.
I'm going to go for a score draw. I'm going to try and be optimistic. That's the best.
Is that
I think that's the most we can hope for in this rate.
Spurs
can't score at the moment.
I'm going to be optimistic. I'm going to go for a draw.
That's not optimism. It is. That is literally as optimistic as me. Like, I mean, we said it earlier. Spurs fans are pessimistic. They are pessimistic.
Wow.
I think Spurs fans are worried. Honestly, Spurs fans are worried about this one because the past couple of seasons under Pochettino, we've had, you know, one of the best defences in the league. Toby Alderweireld missing, Danny Rose missing. It's a very different system. It's a very different team without those players. So not massively confident. I'd love to say we're going to go and win at Stamford Bridge for the first time in, what, 26 years. But I don't think today is going to be the day, unfortunately. So hopefully the best we can hope for, I think, is that score draw to end the winning run for Chelsea, end their clean sheet run. And, you know, as you celebrated the draw at Stamford Bridge last year, I mean, maybe we'll be doing the same this season. I mean, who knows? Lawrence, the outside perspective, give me a little score prediction for this game.
I'm going to go 2-1. I'm actually going to say 2-1 Spurs.
No.
Yeah.
Wow. That would be sensational. I like your style.
I like your style. Anyway, guys, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to Rory Jennings about Chelsea, about his history of supporting the club. Hope you enjoyed this bonus podcast. Rory, thank you so much for coming on the Front Foot.
It was a joy. It was a joy. Thank you so much.
Where can the good people, where can the listeners, the whole, find more of you if they're that way inclined, which they definitely should be?
Come and say hello. I'm called Chelsea Rory on Twitter. Drop us a line. Say Adam Bolt would send you.
Yes, do. Guys, let us know what you made of the bonus pod. Do go and leave your reviews on iTunes. It helps people find the Front Three. You don't have to leave 5 stars, but I mean, that would be nice if you enjoyed the podcast. For now, though, we'll see you on...
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Monday. Bye, Lawrence.
Bye, Adam.
Bye, Rory.
Bye, Adam.
And bye to you, the listeners.
Bye, Dave. Oh.
Oh, he's not. See you on Monday, guys.